Well, hello everyone. If you walk up to most people and ask them, tell me one thing you know about Joseph Stalin, they'll say, well, he was a horrific monster who killed many millions of people. They'll say that the Soviet Union was a totalitarian state and he had a reign of terror. And, well, since I've started researching this topic, I've become increasingly interested in whether this is actually true. And doing my research on Stalin and the Soviet Union, I came across this chap called Grover Fuhr, whose he's got one book called The Moscow Trials as Evidence, another one here called Khrushchev Lied. I've read a good deal of these books. And in fact, I'm so interested in this topic, have I been, that I actually got in touch with Professor Fuhr and asked him to come on. And he's actually agreed. So in a couple of weeks, I should be able to interview the man and ask him some questions about his research. To cut a long story short, Fuhr argues that basically Western historians, historians in general, have got Stalin wrong, and they have taken stuff that is essentially propaganda lying down, and they have not actually sought out archival evidence or primary sources or produce the evidence required to show that Stalin is actually guilty of the crimes of which he is accused. And on the face of it, you think, oh well, this sounds absurd, this sounds ridiculous. But then you start thinking, well, how is it that I do know what I know about Stalin? You know, I happened to see a tweet from Konstantin Kissin the other day, accusing Stalin of 60 million deaths. Robert Conquest, one of the most famous historians, put the number around 20 million. I asked the missus, she said 30 million. Otto Pohl, who's an expert on the Soviet Union, actually puts the figure around 10 million. Other figures are available. Well, there's a pretty big difference between 60 and 10. What Grover Fuhr does in these books is he basically hones in on how this story of, the monster, he calls it the myth of the twin monsters, Hitler being one, Stalin being the other, and of the twin totalitarianism. So you've got Nazi Germany as one totalitarian state, and then you've got the USSR as another one. And he looks at, well, how is it that this story about the Soviet Union about Stalin being this monster came about? And his thesis, I've actually made this kind of meme diagram thing here to talk you through. It should be up on the screen as you watch this. He says, well, in the 1930s, when Trotsky was exiled from the Soviet Union, he was kicked out for what was known as left opposition or the left deviation, and his vehement disagreements with direction that Stalin wanted to take the Soviet Union, socialism in one nation versus the permanent revolution that Trotsky wanted. So once Trotsky was exiled, he first of all, he went to New York and then he went to various other places, France, and then he ended up in Mexico where he was finally assassinated in 1940. But when he went there, to Mexico, and while he was away, Trotsky didn't stop writing. He was writing furious diatribes against Stalin. In fact, the term totalitarian, as it is applied to the USSR, originated in the writings of Trotsky. All of the things that we think about Stalin actually originate with claims made by Trotsky in the 1930s, that he was repressive, that he was running a police state, that he was incompetent, or not incompetent, but a mediocre man, that he was, paranoid, that he wasn't open to discussion, that he was dictatorial. All of these things, your image of Stalin basically comes from the writings of Trotsky. What was pivotal is that Trotsky was writing in English, and he was quite influential among certain intellectuals, leftist intellectuals, in New York at that time. So the kind of basic set of ideas about Stalin comes up from Trotsky. Then, in the 1950s, after Stalin died, Khrushchev essentially coups, performs a kind of soft coup within the Soviet Union, and gives this famous speech called the Secret Speech in 1956, where he announces to the world that Stalin is guilty of all sorts of atrocities and crimes, and that he renounces all of Stalin's works and says that Stalin betrayed the spirit of the revolution, which is interesting because that is the title of a 1937 book by Trotsky called The Revolution Betrayed. And Khrushchev essentially repeats all of the things that Trotsky says in that book, and more. And in Khrushchev Lied, Grover Fuhr goes through every single thing, 61 different claims that Khrushchev makes, and then tries to find evidence for it. He goes into the archives and he says, well, is it true? What's this based on? How is Khrushchev coming up with all of this stuff? Because up until that point, up until the speech given in 1956, for most people in the world, especially leftists and Soviet, you know, supporters of communism and so on, they had no idea what was going on, or supposedly going on, in the Soviet Union. So from that moment, Khrushchev gives this speech, and it's difficult to explain the impact that had. They talk about, for example, people who were committed communists renouncing their membership of the party, walking out on communism at that moment in 1956, as all of these things were revealed and Stalin was discredited. And there are reports of the same people going across the road and joining their local kind of Trotskyist chapter. So Trotskyism had been pretty marginalized and had been pretty fringe up until that point. But from the point of the secret speech, numbers of Trotskyites skyrocketed, while people, the position of supporting the Soviet Union was completely discredited. One of the things I'm going to ask Grover Fuhr when he comes on is, why would Khrushchev do this? This seems like a kind of PR own goal, because it basically destroyed the cause of communism around the world. And still, whenever anybody mentions communism, people will just default to, well, Stalin killed 30 million people. And the origin of all of these claims is this speech by Khrushchev. Then what happened, as we're following our diagram around here, is Khrushchev got various court historians, various kind of ideologists, magazine writers, intellectuals within the USSR who were friendly to Khrushchev, to write, to kind of put meat on the bones of the things that he'd said in the secret speech. So in that period there in the 50s, all sorts of studies were produced making claims about what Stalin did. Then Robert Conquest, who was a famous historian / journalist / kind of cold warrior right winger conservative in the 60s, wrote a book called The Great Terror in 1968, where essentially he just repeats all of the things that Khrushchev says and takes the evidence, takes the data, takes the claims from these studies and articles and books that were produced under Khrushchev, and he takes those uncritically. Now, I've not just relied on Grover Fuhr. I've actually read around quite a bit. There's a number of different studies I've read, and I'm not a trained historian, but one thing I can tell you, because it doesn't take a genius to figure out, Conquest was not, whatever he was doing, he was not doing history. Like, his estimates are wildly, and I mean wildly, off. He is basing things on anecdotes. He's going around talking to people who are emigres from the Soviet Union, and let's say somebody who'd been in the Gulag was released, and then they say, oh, well, how many people do you think were in the Gulag? Oh, 5% of the population. And Conquest just then repeats that in his book. And then he estimates from that anecdote, he'll say, well, oh yeah, that means 20 million people were in the gulag, okay? All of this has since been disproven when they opened up the Soviet archives in 1991. And this Grover Fuhr spent a lot of time going through those Soviet archives. For example, Conquest claimed that there were 20 million political prisoners in the gulag. When they opened up the archives, they found that actually the real number was closer to about 500,000, not 20 million. Okay? And one of the reasons I started getting on to this particular line is because some of the claims made about Stalin don't pass the sniff test to me. Okay? When you actually start thinking about it, okay, think about what the Soviet Union did in those 10 years there. They industrialized. They got up from a disastrous start under Lenin. Not necessarily Lenin's fault, but because they had the civil war. And, you know, the Soviet Union was at serious risk of collapsing very early due to the civil war between the whites and the reds. That kind of devastated things. There were early famines. Lots of people died in that period, okay? So they had a pretty bad start. To come from that bad start and basically achieve full industrialization of a basically kind of peasant agrarian society in the space of 10 years. You know, I think Stalin increased industrial production over 400%. He posts, you know, GDP growth about 8 to 10% every single year. So, okay, you think, well, and everybody basically says, okay, yes, Stalin did do that, but he achieved it by force. But then when you start thinking about it, you're like, well, hold on a second. They lost 20 million people, 30 million people, and an additional 20 million people were in the gulag, and they achieved that. Doesn't sound right. Doesn't sound right. Doesn't make sense. Who achieves 10% economic growth and a 400% increase in industrial output while also killing a massive swathe of the population? Doesn't make sense. So that didn't pass the sniff test to me, which is why I started looking into it. Another thing that has always interested me is that you were always told, well, in Russia, people like Stalin. In Russia, he's always been popular. He was even popular in the Brezhnev era. And he's even more popular now. And in Moscow, they've just erected a statue to this guy. And to me, it's like, well, okay, if this guy killed 30 million people and arrested another 20 million and, you know, was this brutal bastard who ran by terror and they're erecting statues of him in Moscow, something doesn't sound right, okay? And that is why I'm looking into this, because I have a stronger conviction, stronger than my conviction, that Stalin was this kind of terrible person. And I'm sure he wasn't like a lovely guy, by the way. I'm sure there was quite a bit of repression and brutality in Russia, don't get me wrong. Well, what I'm saying is, we're not being told the full truth here, because one thing I'm more certain of than whatever happened in Russia is that what I call the boom of truth regime, what I call you know, the kind of bubble of lies that we've grown up in after World War II, I'm now convinced that maybe 80%, 85% of the mainstream kind of stuff that we're taught probably is embellished in some way or is not true in some way and probably needs to be looked at again. So when I kind of went down this rabbit hole, I didn't really know what to expect to find. I have been really quite interested in some of the stuff this Grover Fuhr chap and others working in a similar vein have uncovered in those 1991 Soviet archives, and other things, like, for example, in this, the Moscow trials, right? The story of the Moscow trials, again, coming first from Trotsky, and I find it very interesting, actually, that, I mean, again, if we look at this picture again, how is it that the Western Cold Warriors, the American conservative neocons, you know, the people in the 60s, 70s, 80s, how is it that their view basically mirrors Trotsky's view exactly? It's kind of interesting when many neocons also started life as Trotskyists, right? And it just so happens that our view of Stalin is exactly Trotsky's view. Something's not right there, okay? Anyway, in this book, The Moscow Trials as Evidence, one of the things that Grover Fuhr does that really interested me is he was like, look, have you ever read the Moscow Trials? Have you ever looked at the transcripts of what was said of the cross-examinations, of the answers back and forth? What were the guys accused of during the Moscow Trials? Just because, okay, so the standard story is, oh well, they threatened these people's families, they tortured them, and because the confessions were coerced, that means that, you know, there was, you know, this evidence is inadmissible, and therefore, you know, probably none of these things are true. It was all made up by paranoid Stalin. But what if the things they confessed to, which was basically a grand conspiracy to try to overthrow Stalin's government, were true? What does that change? It's just kind of interesting, isn't it? I mean, on the face of it, what we're being asked to do is to say everything that happened at the Moscow trials was just made up by the government of the Soviet Union at that time, and that all of the things said there, we, you know, don't read that, and all of the confessions, don't pay any attention to that, but instead listen to anyone who was against the Soviet Union at that time. Let's say every single thing that was said there was coerced, and as a result of that, these men, the men who were found guilty by the Moscow trials, are innocent, which was actually part of Khrushchev's argument. He rehabilitated a lot of the people, and the Communist Party subsequently rehabilitated a lot of the people who were found guilty at the Moscow trials. Well, that logic does not actually hold. It doesn't actually hold. It doesn't really stretch credulity to think that, you know, a group of committed revolutionaries who already overthrown one government, let's not forget, you know, a group of, let's not forget, these guys were Bolsheviks, professional revolutionaries who had fallen out of favour and been kicked out by Stalin, would not then conspire to overthrow Stalin. It, to me, makes perfect sense. There are other elements to it, which maybe I'll get into when I talk to Professor Fuhr. But, you know, one of the odd parts of it is that they think there's a kind of German angle. There's that Trotsky, in some obscure way, was working with the Germans. I'll get more into that when I speak to Professor Fuhr. But one of the things Fuhr does is he shows evidence. He's like, look, at the Moscow trials, these people who apparently had been coerced and were, you know, confessing to all sorts of things, denied having any contact with Trotsky. Right? So at the trials, they denied, they were like, oh, look, we were not in touch with Trotsky during this. Okay? But and yet, he turns up from archival evidence, evidence of letters to and from Trotsky, you know, into the Soviet Union during that period. So it's like, well, okay, they actually lied during the trials, which is a little bit strange if you think that, you know, well, they've been coerced to say these things. They still find a way to lie. Very interesting to me. And it's not just the Moscow trials that he focuses on. There are all sorts of other areas, all sorts of other things that have been said about Stalin. Like there was a cult of personality, for example. You know, that the regime was brutally oppressive and killed millions of people, like we talked about. And on each one of these different things, Fuhr's like, okay, well, you're making extraordinary claims. Where's the evidence? And what Fuhr talks about is an anti-Stalin paradigm, right? That is, you get into a mindset where your de facto move, the null hypothesis, if you want, is Stalin was a murderous, tyrannical bastard, a monster. Okay, and then historians basically try to fit all of the evidence they can find into that paradigm. They don't start from the viewpoint of, is any of this stuff true? they tend to select their evidence, according to Fur, to fit that pre-existing narrative that was originally invented by Trotsky, then embellished by Khrushchev, and then sent around the world and made mainstream by Robert Conquest. And then every other historian copies Robert Conquest. This is a very interesting area. One of the things that got me interested in Fur is the basically the level of his obsession with this topic. For example, he says that in the 1960s he got hold of Robert Conquest's famous book and went through 1,000 footnotes in that book, and then says he checked every single one of those footnotes and found that frequently Conquest took things out of context, made things up, you know, was basically quoting people who were not, you know, who in themselves were just repeating things that other people had said. And basically what you end up with is a kind of lattice, a kind of matrix of people all quoting each other, okay, where you can't ever get to the original source. Let's not forget that the archives were not actually open until 1991, right? So all of the evidence that was produced was just people saying stuff. It was just like, well, this guy said it, that guy said it. Oh, you can't listen to him, can't listen to him. One of the things that got me interested in this was actually reading Molotov Remembers, where Molotov, independently of what Fair is saying and independently of what various other people have said, basically repeats some of the stuff that Fair says here and in those other books. I also picked up a book by Anna Louise Strong called The Stalin Era, where she was an American journalist. She says she was actually sitting there during the Moscow trials. She actually witnessed it with her own eyes and said there was no sign that anybody had been coerced there. The American ambassador to the USSR, Ambassador Davis, who wrote a book called Mission to Moscow, famous book, he was sitting there too and said, actually, I think these were fair trials and I think the guys were probably guilty. There was a British MP who was sitting in the room too, who said a similar thing, right? And this is in a book written all the way back in 1956 by this woman called Anna Louise Strong. So to me, it's like, well, you know, how can I put it? I'm not saying I believe everything that Professor Fur is saying, and I totally believe the guys who are on the other side of the argument. What I'm saying is there's something not right with the story that we're told. It's cartoonish. It's too simple. It's too, at any time you get a scenario where, oh, these guys were just thoroughly evil in all ways, and all of their opponents were innocent in every single way, which is basically the story that was told from Trotsky's point of view, then later by Khrushchev and so on. That then gets the alarm bells ringing, because that is not history. It is propaganda. It is a form of propaganda, okay? Designed to discredit something, whether it's communism in general being discredited or just the figure of Stalin. And we can go into what some of the motivations may have been for that. Stalin internally started to turn on certain sections of the Bolsheviks, and indeed he started to notice certain ethnic groups dominating certain areas. When I was reading Molotov Remembers, I was shocked to learn, for example, that when Molotov became the Foreign Secretary, I think in 1939, just before the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact was signed, that he basically fired every single member of a certain ethnic group from the Foreign Office because they couldn't be trusted. Right, they couldn't be trusted. So that was all the way back. That was in 1939. They were already thinking along those lines. And it's funny, I think, that you get this kind of quick turn. Let's not forget there was wartime propaganda from Britain and America that painted Stalin in a very different way, as Uncle Joe, as this kind of fatherly war hero in a way. And you know, in George Orwell's 1984, you know, we've always been at war with Eurasia, it's or Oceania, or whatever it is. It's like that happened almost overnight in 1946, something like that, where you get this kind of, now the Soviet Union was this you know, power not to be trusted, and that goes into hyperdrive after Stalin's death and Khrushchev's secret speech. So, yeah, this is just a kind of video to say I've been looking at this stuff. I'm still kind of working through it. My assessment is that there's something there. There's something that these guys are onto that has kind of been made up over the years. You know, certainly one thing I've been convinced of is that Robert Conquest was not doing honest history in any single respect. Wherever the truth is, it is not the stuff that Conquest was writing in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. That doesn't sound right at all. Another thing that kind of gets my spidey senses up is that certain people, Kissin being one of them, but there was this guy, David Horowitz, who was very big on kind of anti-Stalin stuff. It's like, well, these guys aren't really trustworthy on any other topic, but we just believe them on this one thing. Doesn't sound right to me. So in my commitment to discovering the lies of boom of truth, I'm looking into this area. Not to say, of course, that Stalin was an angel, or indeed that I believe that communism worked or was a worthy project or anything like that. What I want to do, in the interest of honesty, scholarly rigor, is just to see, well, what is the evidence? All these claims made, but what are they based on? Where can you point to the document or to the, you know, to the statement, you know, in the Soviet archives or even in non-Soviet archives? Where is the evidence for all of these claims? And a lot of the time it's like, oh, well, I read Solzhenitsyn. Well, Solzhenitsyn was a novelist who had a particularly ideological point of view, and of course he was a defector. So basically you're taking the statements of defectors during a time of huge propaganda in the Cold War. Probably time to, you know, look at some of these things again, now it's far away enough, okay? And certainly it may help to answer some of these lingering questions, like how can Russians like Stalin if he is this terrible monster we keep on being told about? Doesn't make sense. How did he achieve, you know, record economic growth while he was also like killing half the population? It doesn't make sense. So this is just a kind of, you know, thinking out loud about this topic. It's certainly been incredibly interesting. I will say that reading Molotov and even reading Fur, make no mistake about it, that, you know, they were authoritarian. You know, there was an authoritarianism, I think, in Stalin's Russia, but the extent of it and the extent to which Stalin was this kind of brutal dictator who didn't talk to anyone, and whether he ruled truly by fear and terror, and whether these tens of millions of people were being rounded up and locked up and so on. To me, that's starting to sound a lot more like a Hollywood version of events rather than what was actually happening. The account from that Anna Louise Strong, who spent many years there going around, I mean, she describes, you know, attending mass harvests, and she went down to see Ukraine during the time of the famine. I mean, there was a famine there, right? Nobody denies this, but, you know, their version of events is a little bit different from what we're used to reading in mainstream history. To me, it just seems a little bit too convenient, you know, that, oh, you know, there's this one way of life that is absolutely perfect, you know, the Western liberal democracy, and it just so happens that both of our ideological opponents in Germany and in Russia were basically the most evil things ever. You know, two twin evil totalitarianisms. You're not allowed to talk about, you're not allowed to go any direction towards any sort of rehabilitation of either of those two things, it's absolutely beyond the pale. To me, doesn't sound quite right. Sounds like an ideological straitjacket and propaganda. So this is my video just to say I'm very much looking forward to talking to Professor Grover Fuhr about this more. And it should be interesting because most of his appearances tend to be with, you know, Marxist-Leninist kind of channels. Me not being one of those, me just being someone who's a little bit open-minded and curious, maybe we might have a very different type of conversation from the other conversations that happen. All right. Pick up a course at the academic agency, Trivium, so you too, or Foundations of Research, I should say, so you too know how to look in all of these little nooks and crannies that nobody bothers to look in, and I'll catch you next time. If you liked this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.